Call the House Committee on Healthcare to order and open an informational meeting. Oh, wait a minute. Let's do some business first. Open up. Do we have a quorum? Yeah. Open up a work session for the purpose of introducing two LCs as committee bills. Do I have a motion on those LCs? Do you have those bills somewhere? Do we have a motion?
You know, we do.
Okay. You thought I was going to do it at the end. I surprised
well,
you.
Well, I can, yes. I move that the, I can't remember the exact language, that the committee moves LC
there's
174. I move LC draft 174 dated 2/1/13 to be introduced as a committee bill.
3037.
How about the other one?
I don't see another one here.
3037.
Let me see what.
Loan forgiveness program fund.
She should have. There's the other one.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chair, I move that LC draft 3037, dated 2/4/13, be introduced as a committee bill.
Representative Kay Geyer moves that LC 174, dated 2/1/13, and LC. Number 3037, yes. Dated 2/4/13, be admitted as a committee bill. Is there any discussion?
Nope.
Is there any objection? So moved. I will now open a public session, an informational meeting on the Oregon Health Plan Transformation. And invite Zach Goldberg to the. Go for it.
Great. Thank you. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, Bruce Goldberg. I'm the director of the Oregon Health Authority and thrilled to be here talking about my favorite subject, something we've all been working on for quite some time.
Dad, wait a minute. Let's not start with untruthful statements. Your favorite subject are your daughters.
That's true.
This may be second favorite.
That's great. Well, my daughters and my wife. Now that I'm
that
for the record,
guess.
For the record,
in trouble.
In which order?
I can continue. One of my professionally favorite subjects, which is health system transformation. And what I thought I'd do is just spend a little bit of time, in essence, just level setting, being certain there's some new members to the health committee, some new members to the legislature, and sort of telling the story about where we've come from and where we are and where we need to go over the next couple of years. You know, the context of all that we've been doing in healthcare has been the fact that healthcare costs have been rising at an unsustainable rate. Healthcare costs have been rising at 5 to 10% a year. Any other economic measure, gross domestic product, personal state revenues, have not been rising at that rate, and that creates an absolutely unsustainable trajectory to the point where it's been difficult for the state to cover the most vulnerable. It's difficult for businesses to insure their workers, and quite frankly, it's difficult for anybody to either afford health insurance or to afford health care if they're paying for it out of pocket and have a medical problem. At the same time, we've seen rising needs, certainly in this state, as the economic downturn of what's been now almost the past decade on and off has had the Medicaid rolls increasing. We've got an uncoordinated healthcare system. Anyone who gets care in it, I think, knows that it's large, often uncoordinated, and that we don't get the outcomes that we would like to get given all the money we spend on it. And then the last context that we are working in these days is the context of federal health reform. I'm really not going to get into that, but just mention it. It's really hard to throw a stone today and not hit a political pundit or a newspaper story that isn't somehow talking about federal health reform and all that's going on. And we've dealt with all this traditionally for the last 30 years in this state, as well as in the country. We've dealt with rising health care costs with three levers. We've either cut people from coverage when we could no longer afford health care costs. That's not solved the problem. Those people still have health care problems. They end up in our emergency departments. They end up in our hospitals and doctor's offices. We really haven't solved the financial problem. We've just shifted it onto somebody else. We've reduced provider payments. We're very good at that in the state. The federal government often does that. And when we reduce provider payments, what happens is those costs just get shifted onto someone else, and those costs rise some other way in the system. And the last way that we've done this is by cutting benefits. That's kind of like cutting people. It's just one bit at a time, cutting dental benefits, mental health benefits, therapies, you name it. Those costs don't go away. They just, again, get shifted elsewhere. So our response in this state has been to, after 30 years of doing the same thing and getting the same results, healthcare costs are no lower today than they were. We don't have a better, easier to navigate system, and we're still fairly uncoordinated. We decided to take another route. And our other route was to fundamentally focus on changing how healthcare is delivered, to reduce waste, improve health, create local accountability for health, align financial incentives, and to begin to pay for outcomes rather than to simply pay for quantities of care. I go around the state and always ask the same three questions: who wants to be in the hospital more, who wants to go to the doctor more, and who wants to take more medicine? And no one ever answers yes to that. No one wants to be in the hospital more. No one wants to go to the doctor more. No one wants to take more medicine. But actually, those are the only ways doctors and hospitals get paid. So our business model has to change. And our response, we've developed over the last several years. 2 years ago, we had House Bill 3650, which created our new coordinated care organizations. And during the short session last February, Senate Bill 1580 launched these new coordinated care organizations. They had strong bipartisan support from the legislature and followed what was a couple of years of some pretty strong public process. During the long session 2 years ago, some people behind the dais, we spent every Wednesday night together for many hours with many people talking about this and working out a lot of the bugs. And then we had community meetings around the state. Over 75 public meetings, tribal consultations have landed us to where we are, which has been really creating these new coordinated care organizations in our Medicaid population. What are coordinated care organizations? They're really a local network of all types of healthcare providers who come together and are working towards the goals of our healthcare system: lowering costs, keeping populations healthy, and improving the quality of care. They're governed by a triumvirate of the three interests I think you want to govern these things. This is about the major components of the healthcare system, so the doctors, hospitals, nurses in a local community, consumers of healthcare, and those taking financial risk. And this is really about creating local accountability. It's about us here in Salem getting out of the way and creating, pushing the responsibility for health and for healthcare down to local communities. There's sort of four pillars of this. One is that these are community-based organizations that have this strong consumer involvement, that bring together the various parts of the healthcare system so that they're working together, not competing with each other. Responsible for the full integration of care. We used to have in the Oregon Health Plan physical health, mental health, dental health organizations. Bringing those together, giving these organizations a global budget, basically an amount of dollars that can grow at a sustainable rate, 3.5% a year at a per capita growth rate rather than 5, 6, 7, 8%. And not just giving that organization a global budget, but giving that organization flexibility to be able to use those dollars as they see fit to meet the health needs of the community. And that's really the fourth pillar. Is this isn't just about being responsible for dollars and cents, it's about being responsible for outcomes. Clear metrics about access and about outcomes to healthcare. So we've been doing a lot of work on this, and we meaning collectively around this entire state. It's been a pretty amazing last 10, 11 months. Since the legislative session ended at the end of February, first week in March, the legislation, Senate Bill 1580, was signed. Communities throughout Oregon began to respond with new partnerships, new ideas, incredible amount of enthusiasm, and an amazing amount of work to create these new organizations and have them up and going today. Just to give you an idea, the legislation was signed. We submitted a waiver to the federal government to institute this. That was on their desk March 4th. It was signed July 5th, I believe, or 6th. We instituted a large state procurement to contract for these new coordinated care organizations, approximately $1 billion RFP. That was done in a four-month period. If anyone who says state government can't work quickly, it was pretty dramatic. We had our first contracts finalized and the first CCOs operational within 5 months of the bill signing. We've instituted a rules process with public input to implement all of this. We transitioned what had been a number of individuals in our fee-for-service Medicaid program into these CCOs. We established the metrics to judge quality and effectiveness, a 9-member committee that did that work. And we finalized our agreement with the feds on December 17th. And we made, so what we asked the federal government for was allow us to institute these new CCOs. We asked for flexibility in how we use Medicaid funding so that things that traditionally we've been unable to use Medicaid dollars for, we could now use, things like community health workers or many people have heard the governor's story about, preventing heart failure by getting an elderly person in a hot apartment and an air conditioner. We can use federal funds flexibly, and we got some dollars to help us institute this $1.9 billion. That's what we asked for. And we made some pretty serious commitments in return. We committed to reduce the per capita increase in costs from where they've been in the federal budget at 5.4% down to 3.4%. We agreed to ensure that quality of care improves, to improve population health. We agreed to be certain that we got good and accurate data by withholding some dollars from CCO capitation until we got good data. We established a quality pool, and we're beginning to shift payment from quantity to outcomes. Next year, 2% of that global budget will be dedicated towards paying CCOs, not just to deliver care, but for meeting outcomes of healthcare on 17 metrics. We agreed with the feds to establish a primary care loan repayment program over the next 4 years and to train 300 additional community health workers. These new CCOs, we've had three waves of CCOs that have come online. Today we have 15 CCOs operational in Oregon. They are caring for approximately 90% of our Medicaid population, now receives care through a coordinated care organization. We're seeing an amazing amount of collaboration and cooperation around the state. Places where hospital systems have competed against each other, and they're now part of the same organization. Places where communities where the mental health providers never knew the hospital CEO, they're now meeting together and part of the same organization. It's really been dramatic. I always remind everybody that although this has been a quick transition, this is just in its infancy. We're just beginning. You know, in gestational terms, CCOs aren't even walking yet. Our oldest CCO is 189 days old, and our youngest CCO is 97 days old today. So these organizations are just getting started. We have them in just about every community in the state. There's a list here, so you can have it. But 15 organizations throughout the state providing services to Medicaid clients. We transitioned 600,000 people from their old managed care and their mental health organizations into a new CCO without difficulty. We created special mail notices, customer service lines were established to aid in this transition. Information and enrollment systems are stable. You know, there's been, you know, a few little glitches along the way, but generally, I think that the transition has gone very smoothly, considering the size, A, 600,000 people, and B, the time with which we've done this. We haven't had people losing care, losing coverage, et cetera. So when you think about these new CCOs, you know, the question is, how are they going to do this? And, you know, there are a couple of, I think, key levers for health system transformation. One is to really focus on better coordinating care. We know that there's about 20% of the population that accounts for about 80% of the expenditures. Often people with chronic disease that are managed by a number of different parts of our healthcare system that don't coordinate well and that aren't aligned together. And so care coordination is a key piece of this. Creating alternate incentives for the delivery of care so that we focus on preventive care rather than simply on paying for care that we could prevent. I always talk about a story that happened in Central Oregon, where St. Charles Hospital looked at the frequent visitors to the emergency department and the 100 most frequent visitors, and I had actually thought that these would be elderly people with chronic illness or the uninsured. And I was surprised, and I think the community was surprised, that primarily these were young individuals who were insured on the Oregon Health Plan, who were coming into the hospital with a variety of physical complaints, abdominal pain, headaches, going to the emergency department multiple times. And the long and short of the story is that they had underlying mental health and addiction problems. Their care wasn't being coordinated. The mental health providers didn't know that they were going to the hospital. The hospital didn't know that they actually had some underlying mental health problems. They created a pilot project, trained some new community health workers, started intervening with these individuals where they lived in their homes, getting them the services that they need. Emergency department visits went down. Quality of life for these people went up. Healthcare costs went down. You know, a great success story. And that's an alternative payment methodology. We never paid for community health workers in the past. We paid for the emergency department. We didn't pay for the home visit for the community health worker. Integration of services and care is key, a community-based focus. And certainly, we look at this as, how can we have 15 different CCOs, 15 different communities that are going to innovate? I don't think anybody has the answer to any of this. What we have are 15 communities that are energized to try. We're going to try and give them the tools to do this and the ability to share ideas and to spread innovation. We're building into this a lot of support. A transformation center as a way to provide technical assistance and innovation. Chair Greenlink.
No, just two more minutes.
Okay, great. Learning collaboratives, peer-to-peer learning so that communities can all learn from each other, support for better adoption of primary care around the state, technical assistance in addressing health equity. Each CCO has a transformation plan. They're being developed to explain how they're going to do this. The first drafts are in. They'll be finalized in March. We've got rules for certifying non-traditional health worker training programs in place. Innovator agents are being hired. We've got the 17 metrics that have been established for judging effectiveness. We're going to begin paying 2% of that budget for outcomes. I sent you all electronically a list of sort of the whole quality initiative and what those 17 metrics are. We're going to have quarterly reporting, which we have to do to the feds beginning in March. Reporting on outcomes and reporting on finances. And we're going to enhance that, make that available to everybody. There'll be an ability to compare CCOs. Transformation plans will be posted. Some examples of some things that are happening around the state, which has really been remarkable already in Grants Pass. Over the last 6 months, they've begun to decrease emergency department utilization for things they can care better for in primary care settings. And that community is focused like a laser beam on being certain that everybody in their CCO is in a primary care medical home and that all of their primary care practices are really certified as patient-centered primary care homes. In the metro area, they're hiring community outreach workers to work with high-utilizing individuals. Trillium Health Plan is making an investment in the local public health department around tobacco prevention, giving them $10 per member per year to help deal with the issue of lowering tobacco use in the community, understanding that in the long run, that's going to be the best way to lower healthcare costs. Umpqua Health Alliance in Roseburg, because of the work they're doing on integrating physical health and behavioral health, has created ways to enhance access to mental health treatment in the community, where they used to see a couple, three referrals from physicians in the community. There's now 75 people who are getting their needs met a month who weren't in the past. We've got some challenges up ahead. Just some of the current and future challenges we're working on or will be working on. The first two, one we have too much of and the other we don't have enough of. We don't have enough time or resources, and we've got a lot of change going on. Change management is hard to deal with. Integrating dental care is an issue we're working on, ensuring that there are robust provider networks to meet needs. This whole transforming care and paying for outcomes is going to be a lot of work. Accounting for flexible services. We've given communities the ability to use dollars flexibly, but how do we account for them? There are no codes in our systems for those flexible services. Antitrust issues we've got to get beyond. Penalties if we fail to meet some of these needs with the feds. How we're going to train and use a new healthcare workforce. How are we going to increase consumer engagement and personal responsibility in health? We've got issues around how we're going to exchange healthcare information in communities that we're working on. And then ultimately, how we integrate this and what's going on in the early learning and the education systems.
Bruce, that was very succinct and effective. Questions? Yes, sir.
So my question has to do with this reduce annual increase per capita cost care by 2%. And how does that relate to what you talked about earlier, the 5 to 10% per year that healthcare costs are rising, or does it relate?
Chair Greenlick, Rep. Lively, members of the committee, it relates directly. What we've, in essence, committed to do in our Medicaid program is to move away from those increases and commit to a sustainable what will ultimately be a 3.5% per capita increase. Right now, it's 5.5%. This next year, beginning July 1, we've committed to taking it down to 4.5, and then the year after to 3.5 and staying there.
Okay.
But most importantly, we've committed to doing that not by cutting people or cutting benefits or not delivering care. The easiest way to lower healthcare costs is not to deliver the service,
mm-hmm.
but to lower the care, lower the cost, but to also improve access to care.
Thank you.
Senator Conger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Bruce. I think, for my part anyway, and I think hindsight history will show that this has been a really spectacular effort by the healthcare community and also by OHA, and I think the results so far are exceeding my expectations and pretty spectacular. With that said, of course, I have questions, and if we need a longer discussion about these, obviously, we'll take them offline some other time, but...
Offline or bring them back here yet, because
yeah.
this
okay.
is not the first time we're going to do this. So.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So resources and carve-outs is my first question. Actually, integration. You talked about integration. To me, there's two levels of integration. There's integration of services, and there's integration at the governance level, both of which are related, obviously, and really critical to actually affecting transformation, I think. At the governance level, I have had a concern, and recently I've heard some, you know, rumors or anecdotes about issues with one part of the healthcare system maybe dominating the governance in a CCO for a community. And I'd love to hear about that on the integration at the system level, service delivery level. I have two concerns. One is, we don't have the system fully integrated yet, and so there are parts of the delivery system that are not in, maybe don't belong in, dental, of course, is one you put up on the slide, but there are others, too. I'm curious about what the future thoughts are there. And on the resources level, I think we've all heard from healthcare providers that their resources are very, very limited, and this ability to integrate requires an upfront investment in order to save money down the road. Are we making sure that every dollar that we can provide towards this effort is actually going towards this effort at the level where we want people to innovate and integrate?
Chair Grunick, Rep. Conger, members of the committee. So, governance. We had a lot of discussions about governance as we put the bills together. And I think that we've tried to allow communities to figure out what's going to be the best balance in their governance. We've never specified numbers. And as I go around the state, I certainly hear concerns about that balance all around the state. Having said that, I don't know yet that we're just beginning. And my sense is it's going to be very difficult to mandate what balance has to be. I think it's a really, really difficult issue. I'm not sure what the answer is. I think, from where I sit, I think we've got to give some time and see what happens, but certainly open to further discussion, about that. I guess I'd say I'm, at this point, somewhat agnostic, and we need to give it a little bit of time.
It's going to be like pornography. You'll know it's right when you see it.
Well, that's been in many ways how we approached it initially. I think, we had a lot of push and pull during the putting together these bills about specifying numbers to assure that kind of balance. I think we've got to be vigilant to being certain that there's not such a discrepancy that I think the spirit of the bill isn't being met, but I'm not certain that I see that yet.
It'll be the spirit, and it'll be the actual ability to affect change, because if you don't have that balance and you don't build those relationships at the governance level, the integration from that flows from that won't occur. Some of the things that you talked about, some of the things that are going well in many areas, where people who had never talked before are now talking, it's because they're sitting at the table together, and it's because they're developing trust and starting to interact and learn about each other's parts of the delivery system. It's really, really important. And I thought your answer was great, by the way. I totally agree. It's not, I would not propose, and I certainly wouldn't know how, to mandate a better system. I just think we do need to be vigilant on this. It's really critical.
I'd agree. And I think what we need, part of this is understanding how to include some of those voices without, it's been interesting. It's been a question of everybody sees having a seat at the board level as being the sort of holy grail of that. When I go around the state, it's actually been more functionally how these organizations have been able to incorporate those sort of partnerships when necessarily haven't had a seat on the board. So that's been great. The service delivery side, we've really been looking to put more and more of the budgetary components into the global budget. We didn't put them all in initially. We phased some of that. I think this has always been about aligning the incentives, and it really gets at the third piece of this. It's about getting all those resources into local communities and having them make those decisions. And what's been interesting from where I sit is that different communities are ready at different times. Some want some of those resources yesterday, and some don't want them till 3 years from now. And that's what we're trying to work through, is how you can get that across the spectrum of the state.
Representative Wyden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bruce, this might be something you get me offline, but kind of curious where we're at as far as enrollees right now, because I know by 15 we were looking at being 733,522 is what I had, at an estimated cost of about $10,142 per enrollee. And I'd like to get some updated numbers just to see what we're actually running into. And then a couple other things. I don't know if you have it now, if you're looking at, and if we're planning on, because 2019, there's no guarantee of money from the feds. How are we going to pay for this at that point? Are we going to look at, because this is doubling the general fund budget, are we going to double taxes on all individuals for this through a payroll tax, or how we're going to handle it? So I want to know the thought process that's going on to look into the future when we're supposed to be handling this by ourselves.
Chair Greenlick, Rep. Widener, members of the committee, we're at about little over 650,000 people on the health plan today, and I think your trajectory is about right. I'll bring you the exact caseload numbers and where we're heading. The cost per person, a little lower than $10,000 per person. Although actually that's about a yearly figure, it might be about that. I'll get you those numbers. And we've just prepared an analysis on the sort of 7-year trajectory, and I will come by. I think we have...
Make that available to the whole committee.
Yeah, this is a great discussion, because I think that we have to create a long-term sustainable funding track for the health plan. We have... we've tackled the cost growth side. In other words, 3.5%. That's sustainable as you look into the future. That's probably a little bit below what state revenues are going to grow by. The issue is enrollment, and the issue is we've relied on a a lot of funding sources in the past that may not be there in the future. And that's been a perennial problem for us in funding the health plan. We relied on some federal funding in the stimulus dollars 5 years ago that aren't here now. We're relying on the $1.9 billion we've gotten from the feds to help us over the next 5 years. Those dollars are going away, and, you know, indeed, you're correct. This is a state-federal partnership, and we have a majority partner in the federal government. They pay right now about 64% of our Medicaid program, and we pay 36%. And we don't have any guarantee, nor does any state have any guarantee of where those federal dollars are going to be 10 years from now. So we've got some issues, and love to come back, present some of that analysis, talk about the caseload dollars, and really go through the per capita figures and where some, we've got some 10-year projections we can share with you, and I think it'd be very enlightening.
We'll schedule that in the next couple of weeks.
One more follow-up, if I may, real quick.
Yes, please. Then we need to move on.
The other thing I'd like to do is look at if we've considered getting a waiver from the federal government to create some patient responsibility for their care as well, where through co-pays and different things like that as well.
We have not to date, but we are. That was one of the things that's on my list of things we need to address. That I think this whole issue of personal responsibility in the entire healthcare system, not just Medicaid, but for all of us, is something that we need to address and tackle. And on our to-do list is to begin to look at how we can do that and integrate that into the CCOs, look at the flexibility we have from the feds. I think there's some new flexibilities. Where that'll go, I don't know, but I think it's going to be a great conversation. It's I've made a commitment to Rep. Conger that we would do that, so I know he's probably was sitting over there smiling as I was looking at you. It's indeed something that we've got to look at. 40% of healthcare costs are really due to our own behaviors. And a lot of this health system transformation has been based on how we transform the healthcare delivery system, how we transform human behavior. It's going to be an interesting discussion.
Okay. Bruce, thank you very much for coming, as always. And we'll schedule that projection discussion
That'd
in a couple of weeks.
Thank you all.
Close the informational hearing on transformation and open a public hearing on House Bill 2329. Will you tell us what we have here?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2329 designates November of each year Chronic Obstructive Pulmonary Disease Awareness Month and declares an emergency effective on its passage.
Representative Tomei, will you join us and bring whoever else you have? We've scheduled about 15 minutes for this. We'd like to
You bet.
Nicely move it.
We will. Chair Greenlick and committee, thank you for allowing us to come to testify today. I'm Carolyn Tomei, State Representative from House District 41. And I've long been committed to public health and have worked for many years to keep wellness a focus in our communities. House Bill 2329 is the beginning of an awareness campaign for patients and policymakers about COPD, which is chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, a largely invisible and very costly disease that is now the third leading cause of death in the United States. It affects 200,000 Oregonians. COPD is a group of progressive, debilitative respiratory conditions that includes emphysema and chronic bronchitis. We used to think of it as a disease that affects only older people with a history of cigarette smoking, but we see now more and more diagnoses of women and other patients who have never smoked in their lives. 70% of COPD patients are under the age of 65. State-level data on the prevalence of COPD and associated healthcare resource use have not been available in all states until now. For the first time in 2012, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention has released state-by-state data from its annual behavioral risk survey that I believe will bring more attention to this debilitating disease. The truth is that COPD is underdiagnosed, and the high cost of treatment is largely due to unnecessary hospitalization. COPD can be prevented, it can be controlled, and perhaps one day cured. But for now, COPD must be on our radar screen if we're to improve the health of our community and lower our healthcare costs. This is an opportunity for us to start an important public health campaign to control COPD. There are others here to tell you their personal stories, but I, for one, urge you to quickly move to pass House Bill 2329 out of the Healthcare Committee and get it on its way to the floor. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and committee members. My name is Carrie Neeson, and I'm the Regional Director of Advocacy for the American Lung Association of the Mountain Pacific. Thank you so much for hearing this bill today. We really appreciate the chance for the Lung Association and other stakeholders to begin an awareness about COPD. Most of us take in about 22,000 breaths a day. For most of us, they're easy ones. We breathe in, we breathe out. We don't have to think about breathing. It's effortless. For people with COPD, simply breathing in and out can be very, very difficult and very, very stressful. Breathing is something that people with COPD think about every single day, every hour. Our lungs are like a pathway that looks like an inverted tree. And at the very end of that tree, there's a small balloon-like sac called alveoli. And that's where we breathe the good air in so our blood can get oxygen to all the parts of our body. And the bad air is removed. And we breathe it out through our nose. COPD affects both of these functions, the exchange of oxygen in and the exchange of carbon dioxide out. Most of us have had experience with a cold or allergies, and you've got that stuffed up nose, and you go from one minute you can kind of breathe in your nose, and then the next minute you can't, you're a total mouth breather. This happens when there's a chemical reaction in your nose. Your blood vessels dilate, your membranes expand, you're producing a lot of mucus. You can't sleep, you're coughing all the time. But we know when we just have a cold or we have allergies, it's going to go away. This same kind of chemical reaction is happening in the lungs with people with COPD, and they live with it every day. The COPD destroys the walls of the alveoli, the little sac-like structures at the end of our lungs. And COPD, it's like a moth eats away at some of the supportive structure in the lung. It makes it very difficult to exhale. Now, I don't want you to do this now, but I was doing it last night because I was reading an article that's saying people with COPD, it's like they take a breath in and then that you exhale a little bit, and then to try to take another breath in and exhale a little bit and take another breath in. It's very, very difficult. It's like you're drowning. It's panic. It's very stressful. So when you go home tonight and want to try that, you can, to get just a small understanding of what it's like when a person lives with COPD. Representative Tomei mentioned the number of Oregonians that live with COPD in Oregon. More Oregonians have COPD than the populations of Bend, Canby, Springfield, and McMinnville combined. More Oregonians have COPD than the entire population of Salem. So we're talking about a large group of folks in our state. The mission of the Lung Association is to save lives by improving lung health and preventing lung disease. And we are passionate and invested in moving forward and helping improve the quality of life with those with COPDs. We're proud to be a part of the COPD Coalition along with the COP Foundation, and we're looking forward to raising awareness and working with policymakers on policies to prevent COPD and to make life better for those with COPD. So on behalf of our coalition, we urge your support of House Bill 2329.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
I'm Cynthia Gage. I'm the testimonial of the person who has COPD. And I believe hearing these numbers that are quoted of people in the state who have COPD, is those are the ones that are recognized as having COPD. And there's a great number of people that aren't recognized as having it. It's a very under-diagnosed condition. And it's a real shame because there's a lot, as you were saying, that can be done before it gets to that critical stage of you're gone, you're flip-flopping in and out of the hospital with bronchitis and other more, and you know, pneumonia. There's a lot of help that can happen. I'm here to tell you about my COPD story, and it's a fairly typical one. Everyone's a little different, so here it is. So smoking, nicotine addiction, like 90% of COPD sufferers, was the source of my disease. I smoked 46 years, trying to stop quite a few times, but mostly giving up because I was so addicted. Insidiously, the COPD started creeping into my life. Shortness of breath caused me to adjust my life and keep on going. The warnings on the packages by the Surgeon General did not say if you were lucky, I would live 5 to 10 years with a debilitating illness. It just said it would kill me, which would alter my whole way of life and my outlook on life. No more long hikes with good friends, not wanting to admit that to my illness or to myself. Gardening had been part of my life since a youngster, and I became a landscape designer. Now I couldn't maintain or create garden in my own oversized city lot. My love and source of being had always been to turn the soil and plants. Today I cannot bend over to work with plants, and digging in the soil exacerbates the COPD with the soil-borne microbes. My two-story house became a challenge to live in, with the laundry in the basement and the bedrooms on the second floor. I sold that home that I loved and moved to a single-level condo, just 10 years ago, because of COPD. Less income from having COPD was the other reason to move. I could not work as much because I was exhausted from the difficulty of breathing. It takes a great deal of energy to breathe. Eventually, I was not able to walk around on job sites or climb stairs and stopped working altogether. I couldn't get around on the job sites. I started Social Security disability with a diagnosis of COPD before I was able to get Social Security. My life has changed entirely because of COPD, not all at once, but gradually. No house, job, income, and poor health because of COPD. Daily living requires moving slowly to get the medications, the inhalers, the nebulizers, which is something you breathe in and through a steam that allows medications to go into your lungs, and pills each morning and several times throughout the day to allow for breathing. Until these medications take effect, I have to pace myself. And the people who have been around me today can tell you how slowly I have to walk, generally. Until these medications take effect, okay. Even bathing and getting dressed are exhausting and require my sitting down a few times during the process. There are days I don't bother and I stay in lounging wear and do not go out because I cannot breathe well enough. Not moving and exercising creates less ability to move around or function, like preparing meals and everyday tasks. It is a continual psychological and physical battle to force myself past the shortness of breath and the fear of not being able to breathe. Not being able to breathe, especially when there is an exacerbation, is like drowning. Gasping for air, trying not to panic, and not being able to breathe. It is terrifying and can last for minutes or an hour plus until medical relief is summoned. To come to Salem today, I needed to go through that wall of fear and have the faith that nothing would happen. This panic feeling can happen just going to the doctor or the store. I asked to be driven to this meeting in case I became too tired or had a breathing emergency. I needed to know how long I would be gone so I could bring extra tanks of oxygen. I have helped bringing them in. A simple trip becomes a journey. I will rest more most of tomorrow because today's traveling and breathing and walking has tired me so much. I don't go to the beach or travel overnight because I would need to bring a large concentrator bigger than a large suitcase and haul that in and out of vehicles and rooms. Everyday lifting of a purse or a bag, a tank, creates shortness of breath because of the exertion. Flying rules for oxygen are prohibitively stringent. Airplane flying, airlines, and the necessary equipment to own or rent is very expensive. Oxygen must be available also at both ends of the trip. Oxygen is considered a medicine and is only one of the many that I take for COPD. The cost, the copay runs from $150 to $200 per month for the medications I require. I get social security,
Can we ask you to wrap up soon, please?
I just got to pour over.
Okay, go for it.
Going for it. to cover this extra help. The extra costs. I also ask for assistance from Oregon Trail Card for assistance. I also get assistance from phone, heat, and property tax. I have been able to work part-time with my landscape design, but the COPD doesn't allow. It has become an expensive way of life and takes public services as well. There are things, though, that I have found in my life as I go to pulmonary rehab, which has been a tremendous help of exercise and education. And so there is a lot that can be done. And I have been on one single maintenance level for the last 3 years instead of a 6% decline like most people with COPD. I've been at the same level, so I've been able to maintain. Thank you very much for your time.
Ms. Gage, thank you very much for your story. It's a very important story. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much to the panel for coming today. Thank you especially, Cynthia, for taking the time and having the courage to come down. And I think this is really important because, unfortunately, we end up not seeing this problem very much because of how much trouble it is to leave your house with your apparatus. Mm-hmm. I have an aunt-in-law that had this, and I watched her through her last 10 years of her life struggle with this. And increasingly, she stayed at home. So your being here really helps put a face on it and bring awareness. And thank you. Representative Tomei, for being a constant champion on wellness and prevention. Thank you also to the Lung Association for your work on prevention. One of the questions I wanted to ask is radon. I think the National Radon Awareness Day was a couple of days ago, and that's another invisible environmental factor. And I note from the legislation that the environmental factors, childhood respiratory issues, genetic disposition, smoking are the main causes. And radon is an invisible gas that is prevalent in certain areas in Oregon, and I wonder if that has been associated at all with COPD. I know it's the second leading cause of death for lung cancer.
Of lung cancer, and I don't know of a connection between COPD, but I can certainly ask that question and get back to you.
That would be great. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, may I ask this witness a question about her mother?
Yes.
Thank you.
Briefly, please.
Yes, absolutely. How old is your mother?
Mother will be 102 the end of next month.
Hello.
And she had a twin sister who passed away a year ago.
So I think it's remarkable, a woman who has these wonderful genes.
And people go, oh, you'll get to live so long.
But I think that's remarkable.
I had personally since my father died of end-stage COPD, so I got to watch a pretty complicated six-week process.
That
was very memorable.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks to the committee for hearing.
Okay, I will close the public. Hang in. I will close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2329. Have a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2329 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Representative moves House Bill 2329 to the floor with a new pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Good idea.
Call the roll, please.
Representative Klim?
Yes.
Representative Conger?
Excuse. Snuck out.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Kinnemer?
Aye.
Representative Blasey?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kenny Dyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Excuse.
Chair
Greenlee? Aye.
Conger,
did you?
Mr. Chair. Aye.
Motion passes. Bill moves to the floor. We'll ask Representative Tomei to carry the bill, I assume. She's still with us?
I'm
still here. Come here, yes. Does that work?
Thank you.
Close the work session on House Bill 2329. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2131. We have a few witnesses. Claudia, are you? You're not coming. Okay.
Are you itching to testify?
Oh, no.
Sorry, I just could not resist.
We actually had three amendments to this bill, too. We'll talk about somewhere along the line. Commissioner Kafoury, will you start? We have also...
It's my job, bro.
Ida Whittem, is that right?
Ida Whittem.
Responsible.
Yeah, I know you. Nellie DeVries. And Bruce Head, too, but that can wait. We'll have...
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members
Welcome.
Of the committee. Thank you.
My very own commissioner.
In the flesh. Very happy to be here today. Honored to be testifying in front of your committee on behalf of House Bill 2131. We hope that passage of this bill will help Multnomah County and other counties collect data to track the spread of bed bugs. Not the most fun topic to discuss.
Would you introduce yourself?
Yes, I did. Deborah Kafoury, Multnomah County Commission.
Thank you.
2 years ago, a little over 2 years ago, housing and social service advocates were urging us at Multnomah County to take the lead on a response to our area's growing bed bug problem. At that time, there was little information about who to call or how to deal with the problem in our community. But the cost of bed bug treatment was already having a major impact on social service providers, and they knew that if they didn't act quickly, bed bugs could easily get out of control and seriously disrupt their ability to fund important basic services. So in response, Multnomah County created a work group. We brought together business leaders, nonprofits, schools, pest control companies, the hospitality industry, and government agencies to determine the extent of the problem and to develop a community-wide work plan. Through this collaboration, the work group has established and distributed protocols and information for prevention and treatment that are widely used throughout the county. While we've been very successful in that effort, what we don't have and what is missing is the ability to track trends in infestations. Passage of this legislation will allow pest control companies to voluntarily provide data to public health departments that can be aggregated to show infestation trends and allow us to use our scarce dollars where they can be most effective. The legislation protects that information from public disclosure so that we can ensure that these companies can maintain their client confidentiality. The legislation does not change any of the current reporting requirements on pest control operators. We greatly appreciate your consideration of this legislation and hope you will pass House Bill 2131 with the proposed amendments.
You have no problem with any of the three amendments?
No.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, representatives. My name is Lila Wickham, and I'm the Director of Environmental Health for Multnomah County Health Department. And I'm here seeking your support of House Bill 2131 with the three amendments. As Commissioner Kafoury mentioned, this bill is designed to improve our knowledge about bed bug infestation so that we can be more strategic in how we address the issues. Bed bugs are not known to transmit disease, so they're not a vector. We know they cause significant emotional, financial distress to the people who have them. Many people try to combat bed bug infestations using dangerous pesticides, home remedies that actually are bad for their health. And we also know that proper treatment of bed bugs is best done by professional pesticide operators. We'll know more about bed bug infestations with the passage of this bill. This bill will not affect health inspection records or any other kinds of records, and there's no public record impact for current records being available to the public from this bill. As you heard from Commissioner Kafour, we did put together a work group, and I just want to reiterate that the membership, the Oregon Pest Control Association, the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging, Metro, Northwest Multifamily Housing, Greater Portland Landlord Association, Portland Public Schools, Portland State University, the Oregon Child Care Division, Community Alliance of Tenants, and multiple housing providers. And I mention that because this entire group of people has come up with a whole set of strategies, one of which is to obtain information from pesticide operators so that we can have a good scan of the problem and see if our interventions are being effective. Our pesticide professional pesticide operator partners have agreed to provide information to us with the caveat that it would not be redisclosed because they don't want it affecting their customers. So good data is essential to the design of any good intervention strategy. So we're seeking this data so that we can have it at the census tract level and actually be able to look at where bed bug infestations are occurring and design our strategies so that they are really targeted to the populations. The Dash 1 amendment clarifies that public health can publish aggregate compilations of data so long as no individual person, location, or business is disclosed or identified. Dash 2 makes it absolutely clear that the bill only exempts data about pesticide applications for bed bugs that is voluntarily provided by pest control operators. This data, as I mentioned, is not currently available to us. The Dash 3 amendment strikes lines 18 through 22. It has always been the intent of this concept that the data only be in use for local public health authorities. So we ask for your support on House Bill 21 with the Dash 1, 2, and 3 amendments and hope that you will pass it out of committee. And I'm more than happy to answer questions.
We may set the session record for the number of amendments per line in the bill. Yes, go ahead.
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nellie DeVries, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association. As Lila mentioned, we participated in the bed bug work group over the last couple of years, and we feel that this is a very good solution, it's a very good idea in terms of being a useful vehicle to track bed bug incidences to reduce and hopefully prevent bed bug incidences in the future while protecting the anonymity of the businesses and buildings thereof. So, thank you.
Maybe you could confidentially report to the committee as to which hotels are infested.
I'd actually like to point out that hotels are one of the smallest incidences of bed bugs nationwide.
Yes, go ahead. Any questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, I had a different question in mind, but I'm curious, what are the highest?
Yeah.
I'll have to defer. Lila, do you know that? Or?
Part of the problem is that we don't have accurate data. However, it really came out of about 8 years ago, we started getting calls from shelters in particular, where people are coming in and out of the shelter space. And of course, that was our initial findings. And then it can happen anywhere. It's not really about your financial status, but places where people continually move in and out of a space or in multifamily housing have a higher propensity than single-family dwellings. But honestly, the answer is we need more accurate data so that we can be more precise in our interventions.
Go ahead.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. My original question was going to be, why voluntary reporting as opposed to mandatory if you're really trying to get more data, and if the data is then not going to be open for public disclosure?
So as Commissioner Kefouri mentioned and Nellie mentioned, this work group came together with really the right intent, which is to reduce the spread of bed bugs and to be able to educate folks and be really strategic. And in honor of that partnership, our pesticide provider partners are willing to give us the data as long as it doesn't compromise their customers. And so it's more honoring that partnership and those relationships and that community-based strategy of rather than going for a legal solution that will require reporting.
So just to follow up on that, I get the part about honoring the relationship between the pesticide user and the client that needs it, but if that information is protected and there's no, OHA is not going to disclose that to the public, why not require all cases to be reported to OHA so that you can keep better data? I mean, you have pesticide users, you know, 10% might voluntary. I'd love to understand the thinking behind that.
I actually think that if you heard the next testimony,
let's hear the next testimony.
Better position to answer that.
Great, I'm sorry, I didn't realize that was coming. Yeah.
Mr. Head, do you want to join us?
Yes, I would love to. Thank you.
You can hang in.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Bruce Head. I'm with Pioneer Pest Management, and I also represent the membership of the Oregon Pest Control Association. We're supportive of this bill mm-hmm. as long as it's on a voluntary basis. When we go to the compulsory basis, I think it will begin to drive some of the reporting underground towards maybe operators that will not be willing to submit that kind of data. We enforce members of our organization above that type of activity, force it on us, and we feel that the information mm-hmm. will not be accurate. You won't be able to get the accurate information. There's a stigma associated with bed bugs that people, the calls we get are far different when we talk to people that have bed bugs, when they do have ants. We spend, you know, sometimes 20, 30 minutes on a call with a person with bed bugs versus, you know, 5 minutes when someone has an ant problem. So we're willing to provide information on a voluntary basis. When it becomes compulsory, we don't feel that you're going to get the level of participation. And to enforce that whole thing, how's that going to happen? Mm-hmm. You know, we're definitely, as an organization, not willing to support compulsory reporting for bed bugs treatments.
Chair Greenlick, could I add something to that?
Yes,
with our professional operators who have agreed to provide us that information, that's really about 85% of the application. So we feel like that's a big enough data set to help us understand the scope of the problem without going down a requirement route.
Any other questions? Thank you all. Thank you, Mr. Penn.
Thank
good
you.
Good job. We like when everybody comes in hand.
Yeah, wait until Gallagher gets up.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2131 and open up a work session on 2131. We have all the paperwork to move this along, and we have three amendments we think we can handle in a single motion. If I had, please.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the amendments, dash 1, dated 2-4-13, dash 2, dated 2-5-13, and dash 3, dated 2-5-13.
Representative Kenny Geyer moves the amendment 1, dated 2-4-13, amendment dash 2, dated 2-5-13, and amendment dash 3, dated 2-5-13. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Amendments are part of the bill. I have another motion.
Mr. Chair, I move that we move House Bill 2131 with stated amendments, the
as
approved
amended.
And as amended, to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Is there any discussion? Oh, Representative Kenny Geyer moves House Bill 2131 as amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
This is here, my
goodness. Any discussion?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Just a clarification, there was no additional testimony or opposition.
There is no opposition.
Thank
yes.
you.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
That's your seat over there.
Yes, sir.
I was just kind of curious if Representative Geyer, Kenny Geyer's head itches as much as she was intrigued by this testimony we had today.
Mr. Chair, I have a serious question.
Yeah, we're in the go for it.
Well, I'll just say that I'm from New York City, and I'm aware of what a huge issue this is. So anything we can do to...
New York City.
See if your head starts itching tomorrow.
I was in a hotel in New York City 2 weeks ago, and don't think this didn't come to mind.
So a serious comment, if I may. I wonder what other states and localities like New York do about this. And, you know, it strikes me that it seems like, given that we're starting from no reporting and that it would be good to start collecting the data, that we should vote this bill. But it also occurs to me that, you know, as a traveler, I'd sure like to know if there's a bed bug problem at an inn on the road or, something, and yeah. might make consumer decisions based on that information. I guess... I don't know enough about bed bugs to understand whether or not it's possible to prevent them from having an infestation in the first place, but if it were, you know, a different kind of situation where the reporting was mandatory and where consumers could get that information and the incentive would be to stop the infestation in the first place, seems like that might be a benefit.
Any other comments? Could you call the roll, please?
Representative Klim?
Yep.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Kinnemer?
Aye.
Representative Wiley?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Excuse.
And Chair Freeman?
Aye. Motion passes. Do we have a volunteer to carry this?
Widener.
I thought you were interested in bed bugs. Representative Kenner will carry the bill.
Oh.
And the work session is closed. Open up a public hearing on House Bill 2432. Is Representative Gelser? Yes. Let's have Representative Gelser and... is the Senator here as well?
Yeah.
My very own Senator. Yes, please. We're hiding back there. Can we also have, I think, one other person who's in favor of it? Lynn Benson?
I think you'll have two.
Pardon me?
I think you'll have two other people.
Two other. Okay. Well, then you guys go first. We've got the other two.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, and members of the committee for the opportunity to come before you today. I have to say, I walked into the room and started feeling a little itchy.
Suggestion is a powerful item, isn't it?
It is. Thank you very much for scheduling a hearing on this bill. I'm still learning my bill numbers. You know, we're on day three here, but on House Bill 2432, which is a bill that was brought to me by Dr. Lynn Benson, who's going to speak with you in a few minutes. The issue is really quite simple. Women who have diabetes, who become pregnant, have extraordinary health care needs that need to be met while they are pregnant that are related primarily to their pregnancy. They require additional visits with their physicians over the course of their pregnancy than do non-diabetic women. They require additional medical supplies and insulin testing and procedures such as ultrasounds at a greater rate than women who are not pregnant. And what Dr. Benson came to talk to me about was the impact that this has on women because the cost is not always covered as part of their regular prenatal care. For some of these women, costs can reach $100 a week out of pocket just to meet the basic needs of basic prenatal care for a diabetic woman. As you can imagine, that is an extraordinary cost that many women are not able to bear. And what she has seen occur is women forego the medical treatment and monitoring that they need in order to ensure the health of the mother and of the baby and to ensure a positive pregnancy outcome, or they leave their jobs or artificially impoverish themselves so that they can become eligible for the Oregon Health Plan to provide that coverage. Oregon is a state that has focused on preventive care, that is focused on providing necessary care for healthy outcomes, and it just didn't make sense to me that in this situation for diabetic women, we would not ensure that they were able to access the basic care that they needed in order to have healthy outcomes to their pregnancies. I can imagine that objections to this bill might be that this isn't the right time, that with all of the changes that are coming in the healthcare exchange, why would we change another rule now? I would say the reason that we should change that other rule now is there are women that need access to healthcare today who are going to deliver babies sometime within the next 9 months. And for those babies and the particular lifelong impact of inadequate prenatal care, it's worth making that modest change now to protect them and to protect their mothers. I don't think it is fair to ask these people to wait while we figure out some other complex issues for an issue that's very simple. I would imagine that another objection to this bill might be that cost sharing helps us to control medical costs, and I think that's absolutely true. We are not asking to eliminate cost sharing for prenatal care. We are simply asking that the prenatal care that is needed by diabetic women be considered prenatal care and be treated in the same way so that diabetic women will have the same cost sharing as non-diabetic women have for their prenatal care. Insurance companies can manage what it is that they cover. If there is an expensive kind of a pump and a less expensive pump that would be just as adequate, I imagine the insurance company can describe that in the same way that they will cover your generic prescription, but not the more expensive prescription. There are other ways to get at that cost containment. But at the end of the day, I think that the public interest of Oregon is in ensuring the birth of healthy babies and protecting the health and the lives of the diabetic women who are carrying those babies. So my hope is that we can move this bill forward, provide appropriate prenatal care to those who need it, and I know that Dr. Benson will be able to talk with you about the experiences of some of her patients, and I believe I have another person here who has experienced this during her pregnancy that will also be able to talk to you about the choices that she needed to make and the medical care that she had to give up because she couldn't afford to pay for it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, Madam Co-Chair, member of the committee, Vice Chair, excuse me, members of the committee, and Representative Gelser for inviting me to participate in this bill. For the record, I'm State Senator Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, representing District 17, and in my other life, I'm a family physician, and I've provided maternity care services throughout my career, professional career, so 25 years now of doing this. I've submitted written testimony, and I won't bore you by reading it verbatim, but I will paraphrase by pointing out these important aspects of it. We know that women who have pre-existing diabetes need to have very tight control of their blood sugars prior to conception, and in order to prevent significant fetal anomalies, birth defects in babies, because these often occur in the first 6 to 12 weeks of pregnancy when a woman may not even know she's pregnant yet. And so it's very important for women who are thinking about becoming pregnant to really focus on that, work closely with their primary care provider or the person who's helping them manage their diabetes, and do the increased testing. Testing alone, if anybody here has diabetes, you know how expensive test strips are, and they're a very big cost. And when you have to be testing much more frequently, that's a really significant added expense to women, and it may result in them testing less frequently, and therefore not having as tight control, and therefore in birth defects that we all would hope to avoid. On the other hand, for women who have not had pre-existing diabetes but develop gestational diabetes, diabetes that only comes on during pregnancy, they have no experience with diabetes and they don't really understand the implications. No matter how well their maternity care provider describes it to them, they don't really feel any different. Their sugars usually don't get so high as to feel any different. But if they don't manage their diabetes well, and that includes testing and doing whatever else their provider recommends, the chances are very good that their baby is going to have what we call macrosomy, or is going to be very large for its gestational age. This often results in birth trauma, increases the C-section rate, results in babies spending time in neonatal intensive care units because their blood sugars drop after birth because they're so used to having a high level of blood sugar in the blood that they're getting from the mother. And this is a huge expense. It's got significant implications. They're more likely to develop diabetes later in life. So helping women maintain tight control by not having that barrier, that cost barrier available to them, is a really critical part of ensuring the health of mothers and babies and avoiding the long-term health implications and the costs associated with babies who are born to mothers with poorly controlled diabetes. So thank you for your serious consideration of this bill, and I look forward to hearing from Dr. Benson and one of her patients.
And Mr. Chair, I neglected to mention that you do have a -1 amendment because we had an error in the drafting that made this apply to prior to pregnancy and after, but not during. Obviously,
it may apply to during conception. And I was wondering how that.
Yes, we have fixed that with a very simple -1 amendment.
Have you seen the fiscal analysis?
Mr. Chair, I have not.
Fiscal estimate that the price to OEB would be $3 million in the next year and $6 million in the year following.
Mr. Chair, having not had the opportunity to open the extraordinary new system that we have called OLIS, I can't really speak to that except for to say that it surprises me that the cost would be that high given the number of diabetic women in the state who might be pregnant over
the
period of time.
Go further today, but because if we do, we have to put a ways and means referral on, so we'll give you time to talk to them and see if you can figure out what's going on.
Yeah, we can go do that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Any questions before we bring up the next two? We have two more in favor. You're right, I misread the X's, and one more opposed. Mr. Widener?
Thank you. Because I'm not sure if we have more doctors coming or not. So,
no,
we have
doctors.
A prenatal doctor right here, I believe. So,
We are having another doctor.
I have a son who's type 1 diabetic, so I know a little bit about diabetes.
He's not going to get pregnant, though.
So, his younger brother did think he had a cervix at one time. So. And that's the exact same response his doctor had, too. So.
Well, I guess it's a cervical spine. But, okay.
And when the doctor and I laughed at him, he was like, "What's wrong, Dad?"
I need that.
Anyhow.
Yeah.
I'm curious how much they have to increase testing, because right now my son, he checks 3 times a day. So, and I'm wondering we're talking 6 weeks before they get pregnant, and lots of times some pregnancies aren't planned out that far and they happen.
Oh,
but I'm just kind of would like a little bit of detail and information, because hearing that huge fiscal and everything, I mean, I can't see where testing more than 3-4 times a day would be necessary, but maybe it is in this situation, and you're probably best to help us out.
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, thank you very much for that question. It brings up some important points. There are some significant differences between people with type 1 diabetes and type 2 diabetes. Generally speaking, the way we manage type 1 diabetes, I would guess that your son, and I know that many patients with type 1 diabetes, are on a 24-hour long-acting insulin, and then they take a short-acting insulin before every meal based on what their blood sugar is then and what they anticipate eating. And that's how we manage a lot of type 1 insulin-dependent diabetics. Now, so your son probably is managed in a similar way to that, and many type 1 diabetics are as well. That being said, so they may not have an increased testing requirement or medication requirement prior to conception. I'm going to get to the question of unplanned pregnancies in a sec. Type 2 diabetes, which is the type that we're seeing an epidemic of now in the United States and really growing around the world, which comes from obesity, lack of exercise, poor nutrition, and some genetic predisposition, oftentimes their blood sugars, because they're taking oral medications and they don't fluctuate as much as type 1 diabetics, they only need to check their sugars once a day, once every other day sometimes. But on the other hand, if they're not well controlled, we often ask them to ramp that up if we know that they're trying to become pregnant. We also have to switch their medications, because there are certain medications, oral medications, that you can take prior to becoming pregnant or during pregnancy, and there are others you can't. So if a woman has to switch medications prior to becoming pregnant, then that their sugars are likely to start to fluctuate, and we have to be sure that they're tightly controlled. So that increases testing requirements. Now, in terms of the question about whether pregnancies are planned or not, this is a really important point. Currently, 50% of pregnancies in the United States are unplanned. That's regardless of the woman's age. It's just as true in women in their 30s as it is for teenagers, whom we worried about a lot. We are working very hard, and this is unrelated to this specific bill, but there are a lot of actions in place, including some of the metrics that are going to be used for CCOs that relate to making sure that every woman of childbearing age is specifically asked whether she plans to become pregnant in the next year. And if she does, making sure that she has the right kind of preconception care to help prevent birth defects and increase the likelihood of a healthy pregnancy. And if she doesn't, that she's using appropriate contraception to prevent that pregnancy. So you bring up a really important point, and I'm glad you did that. Does that help with your question?
Well, and can I add to the question? It's noted in the fiscal that this doesn't define whether it includes also gestational diabetes. And I think that may have a different... I assume it is included, is that right?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
And that might have a different treatment model, is that right?
Well, realistically, for women with gestational diabetes, and I'll certainly look forward to hearing Dr. Benson's comments about these as well, but women with gestational diabetes, depending on how early we catch them and how significant it is, are often required to test a couple of times a day, at least from the get-go. It depends a little bit on how we end up managing them. A lot of them do end up using insulin if they're not tolerating the safe oral medications well, and that means we have to test more frequently. It's pretty variable depending on the woman, and we have to tailor the care to each woman. So I couldn't give you a hard and fast rule about how often these women would have to test, but we would certainly need to include women with gestational diabetes.
Other questions? Well, let's get Dr. Benson to join you and Ms. Turiaf.
I can. Why don't we step away? I think that you have three people coming. So get out of the way.
Step away.
Okay.
Three people? Not on my list, right?
So, and this is Rita Hill, who is an RN who had the experience of having both gestational and pre-gestational diabetes with her two pregnancies. She works in an obstetric office and sees lots of patients.
We've got about 15 minutes before we...
Great.
And one other witness to come.
All right. So... I Lynn Benson, I'm an internist who's worked at, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm an internist who's worked in Albany, Oregon for 22 years in the same office. And one of the many things that I do, like most internists, is that I manage a lot of patients with diabetes, including patients with pregnancy. And what I see a lot, actually I recommend, based on the American Diabetes Association, that people check their blood sugars 7 times a day, before meals, after meals, and every time they drive and at bedtime, if they have pre-existing diabetes, because pregnant women often don't know that they have a low sugar, and so they can be killed in a car wreck, which is not the outcome that we're looking for. The costs are substantial. And it's pretty clear if you come into pregnancy with a hemoglobin A1C in the normal range, your risk of having a baby with birth defects is 1 in 34. If you have poorly controlled diabetes, it goes up to 1 in 9, and that's from 2012 data from Britain. Patient, and I sent something for you, but you, basically you have to have a fetal echo at 18 weeks. You can just tell by the name, that's not cheap. Most obstetricians will start to do an ultrasound to look at fetal growth at about 32 to 34 weeks and continue them every 3 weeks. So you get 4 of those, something like that, during your pregnancy, along with the physician visits. It's tremendously expensive, and what I see over and over in my practice is people have private insurance. They work at a bank, you know, they work at a daycare, whatever, and then the only thing they can do is drop their private plan, quit working, and go on the health plan. So when it costs $3 million, the state is already paying for it in most cases. Most of the people who deliver a baby who have a medically complicated pregnancy are already covered by the current Oregon health plan. It's not a new expense. You're paying for this already, and the private insurers may or may not be paying for it. So, you know, I really believe it's the triple aim: lower cost, higher quality, better patient satisfaction. And Dr. Steiner Hayward and Representative Gelser gave you almost all the facts. The last thing I'll beg your indulgence on is that one of my friend's daughters left a Super Bowl party to help me with this little graph that you got, so I want you to look at it. Okay? And Rita's going to talk now.
My name is Rita Hill. Thank you, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. I've been a patient of Dr. Benson's for about 3 years. I first started seeing her when I was trying to get pregnant with my second child. I got diagnosed with diabetes when I failed early glucose testing in my first pregnancy with my son Jacob in 2008. I started seeing Dr. Benson when I became pregnant with my second child. I was about 10 weeks pregnant when I first came to see her. When I saw her, I was advised to come back and see her every week. I tried to make each appointment weekly, but due to the costs associated with being diabetic during pregnancy, that quickly became cost prohibitive. Outside of pregnancy, I probably test my blood sugars once a week, and that may not be what Dr. Benson would recommend, but at 50 cents a strip, I can't always test, and so I don't. When I became pregnant, my testing went from once a week to testing when I woke up, before breakfast, before and after lunch, before after dinner, and when I went to bed. And at 50 cents a strip, that's expensive. At 6 weeks of pregnancy, I started testing my blood sugars. At 10 weeks, I started seeing Dr. Benson weekly. At 13 weeks of pregnancy, I started taking glyburide, which is an oral medication to control my blood sugar. At 18 weeks of pregnancy, I transitioned to insulin. I'm insulin resistant, so my insulin requirements quickly ramped up. Because of my needs, my pregnancy needs, and what I needed to do to monitor my blood sugars and keep them at an appropriate level changed quickly. Adding up just the co-pays to see Dr. Benson for diabetes and pregnancy, it would have cost me $560 to see her. I was supposed to see her weekly from the 10th week gestation to 38 week gestation and deliver my baby at 39 weeks gestation. With a copay of $20 for each visit multiplied by 28 visits, the result is $560. Adding in the cost of insulin strips, lancets, needles, and visits with the specialist, maternal fetal specialist, this worked out to be about $800 out of pocket a month that I was paying to be diabetic in pregnancy. Since I wasn't able to use less insulin or test less times a day, the only place to save money was to cut out my office visits. This resulted in saving about $60 a month or $420 for my pregnancy. The only reason that I felt comfortable limiting myself to once a month visits is because I'm a nurse and I know how insulin works, and I felt comfortable as a not very compliant patient to self-adjust my insulin.
You did a great job.
Otherwise, coming in to see Dr. Benson so infrequently would have resulted in much higher blood sugar numbers, less control of my blood sugar, and could be dangerous, changing my own insulin. Reducing the risk of birth defects and complications due in large part to the diligent management of my blood sugar, I did end up having a very healthy baby girl. However, as a patient, it was very frustrating to have so many costs associated with diabetes. I was also recommended by Dr. Benson early on in my pregnancy that I was going to need an insulin pump because I was going through a bottle of Novolog insulin, which was costing me $100 a bottle every 3 to 4 days. That's a lot of insulin. So we looked into getting me a pump and went through my insurance, prior authorization and everything. It would have cost me $6,000 out of pocket to get that insulin pump. Then the bottles of insulin to go in the pump. I couldn't afford it. So I gave myself insulin injections 5 to 6 times a day. So thank you for your time. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Nikki?
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. Nikki Terziev here on behalf of Novo Nordisk. We are a diabetes management and treatment manufacturing company. We manufacture insulin and also make pumps and other delivery devices to help diabetic patients manage their diabetes. I'm just a very brief show of support and nod to the co-chairs of the Women's Health and Wellness Alliance for forwarding this bill. We are supportive of any bill that's going to help alleviate concerns and costs and make living for someone who's trying to manage diabetes better.
Question for these witnesses?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Mr. Powell, you want to refute all that high power testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. The dinner discussion will be interesting tonight when my wife asked me what I did today.
You're anti-feminist.
Yeah, I guess. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell. I'm here representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, who urges caution with this bill for several reasons. One, it's been mentioned by Representative Gelser that the 2014 enactment of the Affordable Care Act provides subsidies not only for the premium portion of the insurance sold through the exchange for those in need. That subsidy also applies to the coinsurance, deductibles, and copays. So that's going to be phasing in, and as you've heard from Mr. King, that's part of the difficulty of that whole system, and insurers are in the process of trying to help work through that system as well because they have to interface with it. So the copays of today for people who are low income or in need will at least in part be taken care of with that act. I cannot tell you, as I do not have the charts in front of me, exactly where those subsidy lines happen to be. So that is one of the major reasons that we would urge caution in moving too quickly. The second thing is you've heard a little bit about the management of cost. Unfortunately, one of the way costs are managed through the third-party payer system is through a deductible and copay system. So if you want the best pump that's made, if it's measured by cost, which some clinical evidence shows it really isn't, then you have a higher copay for those devices. Under this act, there would be no allowed copays or deductibles, and thus the person could just select the most expensive one, and I assume that's part of the fiscal that you have received on this issue. The other issues that insurers will face, and that has something to do with the effective date, is we will have to develop systems of identifying when somebody becomes pregnant, and then follow that through the process of delivery in order to time the postpartum portion of this coverage, should you move forward with this bill. Those systems are not in place at this point. There are many detailed things that could come out of this. If a woman finds out she's pregnant, she goes to get a prescription filled and says, I have no copay. And the pharmacist says, well, your plan has a copay. Well, I'm pregnant. Those systems would have to be changed as well, if that's possible. Because we would verify pregnancy by getting chart notes and that sort of thing from the doctor. We have other bills on copays as well. Senate Bill 165, I think, is an attempt to match Oregon law with federal limits on copays and deductibles. Other disease interests, I'm sure, over time will ask for similar things. We're hoping that the Affordable Care Act and the limit on deductibles, or the application of the subsidies to copays and deductibles, will go a long way toward helping with this issue. I would also remind the committee that legislation like this affects about a third of the people who are insured in Oregon. Those are the folks that have fully insured health plans. These mandates do not apply to ERISA plans that are self-insured. So anybody who has self-insurance, the exception to that is the state of Oregon, and fortunately they have agreed through statute, even though they're self-insured, to apply all the mandates that a fully insured plan has to. So we have in Oregon about a third of the residents, because the others are in either self-insured plans, Medicare, or Medicaid plans. So this deductible, this mandate would apply to just that portion of the population. With that, I'll try to answer your questions.
A question, Mr. Chair. Does this not refer to Medicaid? This does not include Medicaid?
No.
Just the private?
Yeah.
I thought it
Medicaid's
was Medicaid.
Already covered, but the bill.
Can we come back? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we had a chance to look at that fiscal, and what we failed to mention before, Oregon Health Plan already covers this as medically necessary. PEB also already covers this. I think we were both a little bit perplexed as to why that impact would be so great for the Oregon Educator Benefits Board, and we will follow up on that. But that would make OEB consistent with PEB and the Oregon Health Plan, and so it doesn't need to cover Medicaid because it's already in our Oregon Health Plan.
Any mandates only cover regulated insurance for such a small group in the individual market. It doesn't cover self-insured, doesn't cover Medicaid, doesn't cover other state programs.
And the state of Oregon has elected to accept all mandates.
Yes, correct? Right.
But it's already covered in this case.
And these things are going to all change with the exchange, so it's getting complicated because the exchange has the essential benefit. I would assume this may be a part of the essential benefits, but then it would be covered with the co-insurance and the deductibles of the essential benefit. I'm going to open up a work session with the purpose of it, accepting the amendment, and then give you a chance to see if you can get a change that, because I don't want to have to send this to Ways and Means if it isn't necessary, and we can discuss it.
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
If I may, thank you very much. I'd just like to add two other points. Mr. Powell brought up a very important point, and we would be perfectly happy, Representative Gelser and I, to consider another amendment that refers to appropriate practices around choosing the most cost-effective medications and pumps and whatever. We never intended for this to be a blanket bill that would allow women to choose and doctors to choose exactly whichever pump. Formularies, whatever other restrictions insurance companies already had in place would certainly apply and wouldn't be treated any differently than that.
And we also wanted to mention, as you may know, Representative Gelser and I are the co-chairs of the Oregon Women's Health and Wellness Alliance, and this is one of the top 10 priorities for that coalition this year, because we think this is a matter of so much importance to women and, frankly, to children. And as Dr. Benson pointed out, we are already paying for this, just in hidden ways.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Close the public hearing on House Bill, where are we, 2432. Open a work session on House Bill 2432 and accept an amendment. This is the motion on the amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -1 amendment stated 13113.
Representative Kenny Geyer moves to adopt the -1 amendment stated, what's the date?
13113.
Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? I'll close the work session on House Bill 2432. Just make a couple of points.
I'm in your airspace.
The committee administrator will have any of the material that was submitted in advance on OLIS, so you need to check in with OLIS before the session or have it on your computer so you can track those down. The other thing is, we are meeting Friday. We expect to do some work Friday. If you have other business and you won't be here Friday, please let me know, because we are assuming we'll have a quorum and we're assuming we'll be moving ahead with it. With that, unless there's anything for the good of the order, we are adjourned right on time.
Thank you.